Hello, everyone, and welcome to Heard on the Street, Street Fights podcast, where we uncover the stories behind the companies, and more importantly, the people that constitute this sector of media and advertising that we all call local. So where are they from? What makes them tick? What business and life lessons can we draw from that? So I'm Mike Boland, lead analyst at Street Fight, and our guest today is Lynn Tornovan, CMO of Affinity X. And before that, she held many positions with a healthy mix of tech giants like Google and Apple, as well as startups in the tech, media, and advertising sectors. So we talked to Lynn from our studio in San Francisco about that journey and what she's learned from it and what we can all take away from that. So here's our discussion with Lynn Tornovan. So Lynn, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Sure. So we have a lot to talk about, including diving deeper on some of the kind of eventful kind of career milestones that I just mentioned. But before we do that, let's start with the present. So tell us a bit about yourself and Affinity X and your role.
Sure. So I am the Chief Marketing Officer for Affinity X. And Affinity X, we like to say that we are the company that powers the biggest names in local. And we really believe that today is the age of local, that local is where advertising is all going, because everyone's trying to reach consumers where they live and work. Often on that piece of glass that we carry in our pockets everywhere we go. Though it's not only about mobile, of course, local also means local print ads and local television and direct mail, right? There are lots of other media there as well. And our company was founded in 2000. We're actually owned by a Filipino conglomerate, but our founders are still with the company. It was a couple who saw an opportunity to help people initially with logos and promotional items. So our founding concept was around creative and bringing creativity to people at all price points and of all types of businesses and business sizes. And we still do that today, even though we've grown now to over 2,200 employees globally, and we offer a wide variety of services to many different clients.
Nice. And I love the construct of the age of local, and that resonates with me as an analyst who has covered local my entire career. And I've always said that local is like Rodney Dangerfield and, you know, gets no respect. And I think that that's starting to change a lot in terms of just the larger tech space, the brand world, and not just the importance of local, but doing the right things to kind of, you know, leverage that opportunity. So I want to come back to that and what you and Affinity X are doing. But first, as we like to do on the show, we're going to kind of go back in time and unpack the career path that got you to this point. So you've played several roles and developed several skill sets, in kind of a what I like to call career cross training. Lots of different functional roles, lots of different types of companies, and I think that's really valuable in terms of kind of creating the skill set of like any successful executive. So let's dive into that, and let's start at the beginning. So where did you start your career, and characterize that time in your life for us, and kind of the initial path that brought you into this world of, you know, tech and media and advertising?
Sure. Well, you know, I started out actually in media. Mm-hmm. I interned at a TV station in college, and then I worked in radio for about 5 years after college. Both of those were in Chicago. Now, my dad was an early employee with NBC News, so I caught that media bug early. And I really saw growing up the value of a free press. And I think much of my working life has been in companies that enable that in some way.
Yeah.
You know, like we were talking about Affinity X, or we really help meet local media companies grow their businesses. But I think overall, all those different spaces and companies you've talked about, like the Apples, the Googles of the world, advertising, it's all been in some way, you know, helping the free press or helping other businesses grow.
Yeah, that list of companies absolutely possesses that kind of ethos. So that's interesting that if kind of you were led towards those companies from that kind of introduction and upbringing, how you started your career. So let's talk about that kind of the path that came after that. So what came next? You, as you mentioned, you worked at Apple, Google, some other companies. What was kind of the progression?
Sure. Well, after grad school, I moved back to my home state of New York. I'm a proud New Yorker, lives in New York City today.
Nice.
I did marketing for IBM for a while. Mm-hmm. And then I decided that I really wanted to see what life was like on the other side of the table. And I got a job in account management at Wunderman, yep, which is now part of WPP.
Yep.
Then in 2000, I got kind of bitten by the dot-com bug, as many people did back then. And I spent a short time at a consumer finance startup. And let me tell you, that stint really taught me how to vet a company.
Yeah, there you go.
A lesson that has served me well since then, because that stint lasted all of about 4 months.
Yep.
Then DoubleClick recruited me back in about 2002 to lead marketing for Dart for Advertisers. And then, you know, I had the amazing opportunity to be there in a time when they were growing, expanding services, went through going from public to PE owned, and then through that acquisition by Google, which by that time I was the VP of marketing for the company. And we actually just relaunched the brand and the company right as that acquisition was happening. So it was a very interesting time to be there and to be in that space.
Yeah.
After that post-acquisition stint that I did at Google, I got really interested in kind of a new up-and-coming thing back then, which was mobile advertising. Mm-hmm. And remember, this is like 2009.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, the year was, what was the year?
2009.
2009. So right about, you know, about a year and a half or 2 years after the introduction of the first iPhone.
Right. And that was maybe the first of 7 or 8 different year of mobiles, right?
Yeah,
every year,
I remember.
Year of mobile.
I remember.
So that was one of those. And I became then the first CMO for Quattro Wireless, which I held that position for about 9 months until we were bought by Apple. So then I became the director of marketing for IAD, which is the business that Quattro became once it became integrated into Apple. And then after I left Apple and did some traveling, I came to where I am today, which is Affinity X, because it was really another opportunity to be the first CMO for a really a growing dynamic company that I thought had a really unique set of offerings that they just needed to talk to the market more about. And it was focused on a new space, which is local. Previously, I'd been really more in enterprise-focused businesses, so I was really interested in taking everything I'd done to that point and applying it to the local space.
Sure. So lots to unpack there, but one thing I want to zero in on first is that the thing that kind of jumps out from that resume is that you were part of not one but two major tech acquisitions with Quattro Apple and, well, actually first Google DoubleClick, then Quattro Apple. And I think at the time, I remember that the DoubleClick acquisition, Google's acquisition of DoubleClick, was the largest kind of acquisition in dollars to date. And they were constantly breaking records like YouTube and DoubleClick. But at the time, it was such a large acquisition. But the question really is, having been through two of those, I'm curious about your perspective on kind of M&A dynamics, whether it be like culturally speaking or strategically. What kind of lessons did you take away from both of those?
Well, I've lived to tell the tale. So lesson number one is that you can go through those types of acquisitions and actually thrive. I think, you know, there's no real magic in successful M&A. I think the ingredients are pretty well known. You know, you could read Harvard Business Review articles, McKinsey articles, but it's actually really hard to do well. So there seems to be a recipe, but it's hard to do it really well, right?
Yeah.
In many cases, it's the strategy behind it that is the reason that the M&A fails.
Yes.
Because there really isn't a strategy. Or an example would be, you know, right after the DoubleClick Google merger or acquisition of DoubleClick by Google, I should say, then you had Microsoft buying Aquantive.
Yep, that's right.
And as we know that over the years, that did not work out so well for Microsoft. And that business did not thrive. Whereas on the other hand, DoubleClick thrived under Google, and I think really was the rocket fuel for the non-search ad business at Google. So, you know, I really feel that part of that was the strategy behind the deal, and that Google had a really clear strategy of where they wanted to go and knew what was the right company to get them there. And it seems that Microsoft did not have that clear strategy. It was more of a case of, we need to be in this business, so we got to buy somebody quickly to do that. So strategy really drives it.
Yeah,
and of course,
the I don't know, kind of HBR articles that I've read on or case studies I've read on M&A activity, it always seems that the pitfall is in what you just said, where it was kind of hastily done, but also culturally, where it works on paper, but something that is hard to detect on paper, which is culture, seems to be sometimes the pitfall when mergers and acquisitions go wrong. Have you seen that either in your experience or just kind of elsewhere? It seems like Google DoubleClick was a best practices example, But, you know, have you seen others where you think that that's not the case?
That's a good question. I don't think I've been personally involved in one in which there was a large cultural mismatch or culture prevented the acquisition going forward. I mean, at DoubleClick, we actually acquired several companies in the time I was there. Generally, I believe that a lot of what gets called cultural mismatch may be really around miscommunication, because communication is really kind of the fulcrum that I think determines whether or not the M&A is successful, regardless of the strategy behind it. If you don't have really clear communication with the employees in the market as to why this is happening, and then really clear with your employees, in particular, the impacts, because look, we all know M&A usually means the jobs are going to change or jobs are going to go away, right? So continuing to communicate long after the deal is closed, and not just saying that the press release on the deal close date is like, I've checked that box, but keeping that communication open, I think can address not all, but some of those issues that happen around that idea of cultural clash or cultures not mixing. And it also depends on what you define as culture, right? So is culture having, you know, food every 100 feet? Is culture, you know, free drinks on Fridays? Or is culture more, do you allow constructive dissent in meetings? Do you have the type of organization that recognizes the whole person? Or are you a very driven organization who believes that work should be number one for everyone? I mean, those types of things, there could be a mismatch in those. The style of working and the kind of point of view on the role of work in life, that certainly if the companies come at a merger and they're very different on those things, that could cause some friction. But they could still, again, be addressed, I think, with appropriate communication.
Oh, absolutely. And I've heard a lot of good things about Google's culture and its, you know, power structure, and things that were instituted by Eric Schmidt, and others regarding kind of some of the, I guess, organic power structure. And in their case, a very kind of engineering first culture, in terms of how ideas are pushed through, in terms of implementation. But I think your larger point is great, which is that, you know, it's really about good planning. And then after that, you know, press release and everything, the actual implementation, which of course takes discipline. So we're going to pause there for a commercial break. But when we come back, more with Lynn Tornabene. Hi everyone, it's Mike Boland, lead analyst at Street Fight, and I'm here today to tell you about Artillery, which is a new publication and intelligence firm that's focused on VR and AR. Mobile AR, for example, has a large installed base of smartphones and real business models that are materializing around things like influencing local commerce. So we recommend that you go check out the site and its thought leadership of these key topics. And while you're there, you can sign up for the free Artillery Weekly newsletter. So head on over to artillery.co, that's artillery without an E, and learn about some of the visually immersive technologies that could transform local commerce. So we're back. My guest is Lynn Tornabene. So Lynn, before the break, we were talking about some of the companies you worked at and points in your career that influenced you as an executive, and your kind of current role and the principles you're carrying forward. One thing that kind of fits into that category was your time at Apple during the launch of iAd. And I'm not sure if everyone remembers iAd, but it had a lot of influence in what I see as a kind of big movement of reform over the last 10 years or so to make ads better, whether it be, you know, campaign targeting, whether it be creative, all the kind of components of display ads. And the kind of quote from Steve Jobs when he said, you know, ads suck. And Apple is all about quality standards, especially at that point in the mobile things they were doing and with apps. But yet the ads happening on those apps kind of tainted the experience, and there was that mismatch there. So I think that that was one inflection point I remember in the subsequent decade up until today of a lot of just kind of standards improving. We've come a long way. I think we have a long way to go, but I'm really curious about your perspective on kind of the influence that had, particularly through the lens of someone that was on the ground there as I had, as was launching it and kind of a key part of it with the technology and the strategy that was based on Quattro, which is the company that you came from that Apple acquired. So tell us about that, please.
Oh, sure. That was one of the key drivers of the acquisition. And particularly, as I understand it, it was really one of Steve Jobs' passions, was the idea that The apps created for the device by all the app developers were beautiful. The devices themselves were beautiful. But the experience for those consumers of those devices when seeing ads was not so beautiful.
Right.
And he did use the word suck. And the idea was that Apple felt that they could apply their creative expertise. I mean, it still wins all these awards. It's sort of like one of the top brands in the world as far as the expression of a brand. And so Apple in the DNA has that creativity and the ability to express a brand. So taking that ability and applying that to the ads that were on the devices was one of those drivers. And so we actually had, a part of iAd, our own creative team. And that team actually worked with our large advertisers, which were generally at the beginning, you know, large CPG financial companies, and worked with their agencies to take advantage of what they could do on these devices. So you no longer need to just have a little banner on the bottom, but there were so many things we could take advantage of within iOS and within the real estate there to make the ads engaging and interesting. But they needed Apple's help in order to do that, because the agencies, you know, this wasn't a focus, right? What creative back in 2009 wanted to be making mobile ads? No, they wanted to still be on TV, right? That's where you won awards. You didn't win awards for a mobile banner ad.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of work to really elevate that creativity and to make that more of a focus. And I think, as you noted, helped to kind of drag the industry forward.
Yeah.
And other companies now, Google has come out with their, you know, quality ads initiative and getting rid of bad ads. So I think that there is certainly a way to go in the industry. I would not say that all the ads that you see on any device are all beautiful and interactive and engaging and all protect your privacy. But I do think that iAd did have an impact on that and showed what was possible. And even today, you know, bringing it back to sort of where I'm at today with Affinity X, one of our core tenets of our company is this idea of bringing great creative to businesses of any size.
Yeah.
So local advertising can have that same great creative and engagement and really attract consumers and provide them with a great experience, whether the ad is for a large brand, national brand doing a local ad, or it's just for the local mom and pop, like the florist or the auto dealer.
Yep. Well, and one thread I'm seeing there, which is very interesting, is it's about providing the tool sets to achieve those quality levels. So Apple first did that with the first iOS SDK for apps, for people to kind of, rather than build homegrown things, it's a tool set to build something that has a quality standard. iAd then had that same principle, providing a tool set for advertisers to do something better. It seems like you guys are now doing that and bringing that quality standard and democratizing it for advertisers of all sizes. So it's an interesting thread there.
Right. In our case, similar to what iAd had, is that we have a creative team. Now,
yeah.
iAd had a fairly small team. We have almost 2,000 creative people. So, you know, we apply human creativity to the needs and wants of those local businesses and the consumers that they want to reach. Because we're still believers in this age of artificial intelligence, in this age of bots, in this age of automated creative, that actually a human being is still the best tool.
Yeah, very interesting. So that brings us back to the present. And I'm curious about some of the most exciting things that you're working on today, what you're seeing in today's environment. You've talked before about this concept of the age of local. You mentioned that at the front end of the show as well. And this is, I want to give you a chance to kind of drill down on that and how you're applying that into what you guys are working on today.
Oh, sure. You know, it's a concept that we came up with this year at Affinity X because we're keenly aware that marketers today win or lose based on local relevance, mm-hmm. as we talked about a little bit earlier, right? So whether you're a big brand or a mom and pop, it really, your success is not about doing a mass campaign with annual planning and you just sort of sign the IO and you've done your TV plan or your, you know, magazine buy for the year, that it's really kind of an ongoing skirmish down at the local level. And planning has to happen all the time. But there's a lot of technologies and channels today, like programmatic, social, connected TV, that enable the mom and pop and the national brand to duke it out there to reach out to the local consumer and to get their, you know, share of mind and kind of convince them to buy their product. And it's generally digital, although of course, you know, there's a lot of this still going on in the print, TV, and radio space on the local space. But, we really do believe that this is a golden age for marketers and being relevant to consumers. And because of the technology, because of the companies like us that are out there able to offer things at the right price points and the right packaging for local businesses, that they can all compete.
Mm-hmm. Now, what
and
are
competition's
some...
good for consumers.
Absolutely. What are some of the metrics that you generally use to convey the benefits and the virtues of local or effective and well-executed local mm-hmm. strategies? For example, I do a lot of market forecasting, so I'm always looking at terms such as when campaigns are targeted locally, whether it be a display campaign, whether it be a search campaign, it sees a certain kind of delta in terms of performance, whether that be click-through rate, whether that be kind of other KPIs. What are the types of things you're seeing in terms of, unpacking that term local relevance in kind of some proof points of the kind of performance deltas that advertisers can expect when they do it right?
Oh, sure. We generally see with our when we're talking about programmatic display campaigns, as an example, we generally see that our campaigns get about twice the click-through rate that you see on the national benchmarks. Hmm. Now, I've never been a fan of click-through,
sure.
but it is what it is,
yep.
right? And it's something you can benchmark against. And
yes.
so I think that that engagement does show that there is local relevance when you think about the local consumer and you're doing the ads kind of on that level programmatically. Geo-targeting, geo-fencing, and those kinds of things. But ultimately, it's about sales, right? And so, remember, we're white label. So I'm not selling to the local business or the national brand. Typically, I'm selling to a local media company
yep.
or to a large e-commerce or retail company, and they're selling to that business. So both our customers and their customers have seen lots of revenue growth, new revenue, from implementing things like programmatic campaigns. So our clients tell us that their customers are very happy, many of whom have never invested in digital before because they've been afraid to do it, didn't know how to do it. But when that trusted newspaper or radio or TV rep that they've known for years, play baseball with, knocks on the door and says, hey, I can get you into this new space. It's not scary, but it's actually going to help grow your business. Then, they're more open to do that and they do that and then their business grows. And I think that's great. I love that I come to work every day helping people grow their passion and their business.
Yeah. And yeah, don't get me started on the click-through rate. You're right that it's a good benchmarking tool, but not really effective in terms of truly getting kind of effectiveness and ROI. I wrote an article in 2009. It was an op-ed called "Let's Lose the Click-Through Rate," and that was right around the time of smartphone mobile ads. And at that point, I thought it was just not the right, and it was inherited from the desktop. And all these years later, we still have it.
No, I'm sorry that you were not successful.
Yeah.
One of the things actually we did at IAD is I worked with Nielsen, and we developed a custom way of measuring the brand impact of ads.
Uh-huh.
Because IAD was different, it was built into the iOS, we could do something different as far as measuring the impact. And we focused particularly on, again, those brand measures, favorability, intent, and not on
right.
clicks.
Mm-hmm.
But, again, even those are not the same as actually measuring sales.
Oh, absolutely. So we're going to pause again there for a commercial break. But when we come back, more from Lynn Tornabene. Hi, everyone. It's Mike Bolin, lead analyst at Street Fight. And I'm here today to tell you about Artillery, which is a new publication and intelligence firm that's focused on VR and AR. Mobile AR, for example, has a large installed base of smartphones and real business models that are materializing around things like influencing local commerce. So we recommend that you go check out the site and its thought leadership of these key topics. And while you're there, you can sign up for the free Artillery Weekly newsletter. So head on over to artillery.co, that's Artillery without an E, and learn about some of the visually immersive technologies that could transform local commerce. So we're back. My guest is Lynn Tornabene. So Lynn, we spent a lot of time talking about the things you've learned throughout your career, what you're working on now. One thing that our audience always likes to hear about are tactics for not only kind of career success, but also things like work-life balance. Things we all do in our personal lives to enrich us as people, which then kind of translates into being effective professionals. A lot of that involves travel. And you spent a year in Asia, actually, during a career pause around, I think, 2012. Tell us about that.
Sure. What happened was it was an inflection point in my career. So when I was leaving Apple and one of the things I've always done in life is ask questions. And I think if I would give anyone career advice, it would be ask questions all the time, right? Because the right question can lead to amazing things. And when I was leaving Apple, I asked my husband a question, which was, why not now? And the why not was about, we'd always dreamed about doing something more than just a 2-week vacation. And I thought, this is the time to do it. And so my son was in kindergarten, which in New York is not required. So he went for the first half of the year, and then we took him out. And then we spent actually 6 months on the ground in Asia, traveling to 10 different countries. And, you know, it wasn't an easy decision because I had to say, I'm not going to look for my next opportunity for a while. And my husband's a stay-at-home dad. So it's not that we had another income coming in, or we had, you know, where insurance was going to come from and all that. But again, I just thought, you know, why not now?
Yeah.
There's no way I could enrich my life more and the life of my son than by doing this. And I can't recommend that kind of pause even more. I mean, where else could you watch a 6-year-old teach teenagers English in Indonesia? Or, you know, one of our drivers in Vietnam had been a senior military officer in the South Vietnamese Army in what they call the American War. And so having that conversation, both for me and then for my son, you know, learning it from someone who experienced it, you can't replace that by reading something in a book, you know? So our family mantra is experiences over things. And I would do that again in a heartbeat. And I'm sure it's made me a better employee, a better manager. I brought new perspectives, you know, to what I do at work. And, you know, I would love to do that again if the time and the opportunity arose.
And I love experiences ahead of things. The one other place I've heard that, which they probably stole it from you, is the millennial generation are famously known for experiences over things. And I think that's been one of the things that's allowed the on-demand economy, or at least certain parts of it, to thrive. So let's go right into our lightning round now. So just a series of quick hit questions that we will roll through to kind of find out a little bit more about kind of the interesting things that make you tick. So what's something about you that few people know about?
Well, apparently I've always been a marketer because I sold rocks door to door in my neighborhood when I was about 5.
Nice. So what's a profession that you'd want to have, speaking of which, if you weren't doing what you're doing now and kind of being in the world of marketing?
Sure. I mean, I love what I'm doing today, but I think I've always thought that in another life or maybe another stage of this life, I would like to be a teacher.
Ah, it's very interesting. Yeah. And you could see some of that in the way you were talking about the trip to Asia. In terms of some of the educational elements of that. Now, the answer to the following question, most people's answer to the following question is usually, you know, companies like Google and Apple, and you had the benefit of already having worked there. But what's a company or a tech startup that you think would be most exciting to be a part of, either at the moment of inception or at any growth stage? What are some companies you admire and would want to be part of their mission?
I would think Virgin, actually. I think Richard Branson is a fascinating man, and to be able to like work under him or with him, you know, as he think about all the business models and industries that he has disrupted in his company, right? Music, telecom, transportation. Now they're going to space. So I think that would be fascinating to be at that sort of top level in a company like that, that isn't just disrupting one business or one model, but many.
Absolutely. And there, it's so rare throughout history that you get visionaries and disruptors on that level, like an Elon Musk or a Richard Branson. So I think that's a great answer. And we haven't gotten that answer from anyone yet. So who's a person, you know, in a non-business context that you'd most want to like have a drink with or just kind of pick their brain?
I think a drink with Neil deGrasse Tyson would be great.
I agree.
Because he is fascinating and like a polymath. I mean, just interested in so many different things. I could ask him a lot of questions.
Right. That's a great one. What superhero power would you most want to have?
Omnilingualism. So that would be the power to speak and understand any language anywhere. Mm-hmm. Think about how amazing it would be to travel the world if you could speak to anybody anywhere. And you could even maybe help preserve languages that are going away because you could translate them. But I've always wished I could get deeper into the culture by really being able to speak and say more than just hello.
Well, Google Translate might kind of come along and have a technological solution for that, or at least get us a certain degree towards that superpower. I think the voice processing still has a ways to go.
Not the same as when it's in your brain, I think. And
Oh,
people, when
absolutely.
it's intermediated by a technology, you don't get that same human-to-human connection.
Well, I absolutely agree, and the kind of the conjugations that you form in your own brain are much deeper than just the verbal communication. What are some of your personal goals for 2018?
Personally, I would like to work on the craft of photography more. Something I've gotten interested in the last few years. I've taken a few classes, but it's a lifelong kind of pursuit. So it's nurturing that creative side. Of course, I'd like to spend more time with my family, but that doesn't mean I'm leaving my job. It's not that statement. It's just I love spending time with my family. And we're hoping to do some more interesting travel this year. Don't have that scheduled yet, but I think that idea of nurturing my creativity and then spending time absorbing others' creativity. I'd like to go to museums more. We have the greatest museums in the world in New York, and every weekend you're kind of like, oh, I should go, right? So kind of absorbing creativity more and working on my own.
And I love the photography answer because I've been an amateur photographer for years, and slowly assembling all of my gear and spending a lot of time doing it and just kind of sharpening that sword as a way to unwind. So we should geek out about photography sometime.
Absolutely. Again, it's not the tool, it's the person,
It
right? It's your
is.
eye and what you see. That's
Yep.
what gives a photographer, that's the emotion comes through because of what you're capturing and the emotion of the moment, not necessarily the tool.
I think photography brings together many aspects. It is being able to frame shots, block shots, that creative eye, but I think also there are certain mechanics to it that I love too. I mean, it's almost like it's a melding of right brain and left brain activities. And the mechanics of it, the lighting, the settings, all of that stuff. It's fun. So, we will certainly geek out about that next time we see each other. But that's all the time we have. I want to thank you, Lynn, for spending time with us.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Sure, and thank you all for listening, and stay tuned for future episodes of Heard on the Street. You can find us on streetfightmag.com, and you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts. Also, stay tuned for lots more writings and multimedia from Street Fight. So this has been Heard on the Street. I'm Mike Boland. Thanks for listening.